Hi, and welcome to Revision Media here. This is Thursday, the 20th of August, and we are live here for the next hour through till 11 p.m. Here in London, England. I think that's 5 till 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Welcome, everyone, to Revision Media. You know, I was listening to a video earlier by a couple of guys who live in reality. There are very few people who actually live in reality these days. It seems to me that there is a fog of insanity over the Western nations, particularly. I mean, you know, the third world nations, they're used to oppressive governments. Why do you think we have so many brown people coming into this country? They're easier to control. They are used to being controlled and dominated and are part of a totalitarian system. So if you hate the West, which Jews do, which they want to subvert our culture and control everything, the Talmudic Jews, which came out of Babylon in the early centuries and killed Jesus Christ, and killed the embodiment of everything that is good and righteous. Of course, they're going to want to eventually, you know, get rid of white people in their own nations. So that's why you have brown people in the Western countries. I say brown people, I mean people. It doesn't matter what color they are, really. They're from nations which are used to oppression. In some cases, it's because their IQ isn't big enough to deal with it. Certainly in Africa, that is the case. There are very low IQs in Africa, very easily to control. We now have a situation in the West where we have a lot of Africans with very low IQs and Jews with very high IQs in many cases. But in most cases, it's also a case of ethnocentrism, but they control all the institutions. So that is the worst of both possible worlds for European nations, which have been Christian and, you know, have done pretty well in many ways for centuries. America, of course, was the ultimate, you know, situation. I mean, America was aberrant, is aberrant. Its foundation is aberrant. It was built on freedom. The Western nations. I mean, America got free from the European and English central banks. They're not free of that anymore. The Federal Reserve came in there. They took control of the, in quotes, money supply. And they destroyed it in a century. Henry Ford was right. Henry Ford, everything he said was absolutely right. No one listened. No one's still listening. Most people have a fog of insanity over what's happening today. They're not listening. Noah's Ark. How many people are on the Ark? 70? I think they were warning about it for 1,000 years, or certainly many centuries. So we have a lot of people in this country today who are used to being controlled. White Western Europeans have been a problem for Jews. It's as simple as that. And I say Jews, I'm talking about Talmudic Jews, those who run the banking and finance, the lending and the lies, the money and the media. You know, those are the two big ones, and they're in, of course, they're in academia as well to spread their Marxist BS as well. Anyway, I was listening to, ironically, by a Jew who I like, Peter Schiff and Stephen Moore. He's also an economist, and I was going to break this down earlier, but I just thought, you know what, I'll just play the video. It encapsulates a lot of economic themes, a lot of economic tensions. The big argument today in the economy, of course, is whether it's deflation or inflation. Schiff, of course, is a big inflation guy. He explains inflation very well. I think Schiff, in most parts, for the most part, schools anybody that I've met. He is a bit belligerent, but I think he has truth on his side for the most part. As I say, ironically, he's Jewish. But This is a good video. It also encapsulates, the coronavirus hoax. These guys are not maybe as forthright exactly the way we would be on this show and on RBN, because I think Schiff never really attributes anything to conspiracy. That might be his Jewish nature. I don't know. Maybe it's just what he believes. But at the same time, he does blame the Fed. It's just like, to some extent, largely, he blames it on incompetency and all that. Is it a coincidence that these central banks get richer and buy up all the assets all the while they're being incompetent? I don't think so. I don't think that's stupidity. I think that's theft. And I think Schiff knows that as well. But anyway, here it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another great session of the Money Show Virtual Expo. We are doing what the government allows us to do. We can't meet in person. Our First Amendment right to freedom of peaceful assembly has been abridged. The First Amendment has been violated. But nevertheless, we are here. My name is Mark Skousen. I'm the editor of Forecasts and Strategies. I am a professor of economics, finance, and business at Chapman University. And it's just a thrill to have a little bit of a debate here between Steve Moore and Peter Schiff. So let me introduce each one of them. Steve Moore, I've known for 20 or 30 years, a long period of time. He has been around the Washington scene for many years as the chief economist of the Heritage Foundation, as a very important member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, and still writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal, and has written a number of books with Art Laffer and others. Larry Kudlow he's very closely connected with the supply side economics, the ideas of supply side economics. He's an advisor to Trump. And at one point, he was nominated to be a member of the Federal Reserve Board. That didn't work out. And I don't know, Steve, if you feel that's if you would have liked to have had that position, I think. But there's a lot of pressure in Washington, a lot of divisiveness. Before you answer that question, Peter Schiff is also a longtime friend of mine. He is the president and CEO of Europe Pacific Capital. He's based in Connecticut. Steve is based in Washington, D.C. I'm out here in California. So we're from all over the country. And Peter Schiff is a great author. I think his best book is The Real Crash. That's just my personal opinion. But it's a brilliant book that goes into a lot more detail about policy and what is sound economics and what is unsound economics. He's been a regular speaker at the conferences. And his claim to fame, of course, is having called out and predicted the 2008 financial crisis. I particularly remember his big debate with Art Laffer. That was really an exciting moment in his life. And so we welcome both of you on this program. And let's start off by talking about let me give you an example of what we want to talk about. And is the government in a situation like Humpty Dumpty? Has he fallen and can't be put back together again? If you look at the charts of of the government spending programs, is it not out of control? Would this be a case for, can we really put Humpty Dumpty back together again? Steve, let's start with you, since you are a big supporter of Donald Trump. One of the promises he made is that he would balance the budget and reduce the national debt. It's one of the very few things he always makes a point that he tries to keep his promises, but that's obviously one that he hasn't been able to keep. Are we digging a hole that's so deep that we can't get out of it? What do you say?
Hey, Mark, Peter, great to be with you, my friend. Well, That's a great question and something I've been pondering a lot. In my earlier session today, I showed the charts about how government was out of control, that for the first time in American history, if we pass this $2 to $3 trillion spending bill, which they call a stimulus, that would bring government spending at the federal, state, and local level to, by my calculations, somewhere between 50 and 53% of GDP. Now think about that. Everybody ponder that for a minute. That means for the first time in American history, the government sector of our economy would be larger than the entire private output of every private worker and private business. That's a scary thing to think about. It's something that I would say that someone like Bernie Sanders, who's an avowed socialist, I don't think even in his wildest dreams we'd ever see an experience like that where the government would be larger than the private sector. Both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, have drunk the soup, the Kool-Aid in Washington that says that government spending is a stimulus. I'm here to tell you, as I've said for 25 years, government spending doesn't stimulate anything except government. And I believe that the government spending actually on balance has been negative for the economy. There were a lot of mistakes in that CARES Act. I did support, Mark, a lending program for businesses because it was an extraordinary event with, caused by government of shutting down the economy, which, by the way, just as an aside, I think will go down in history as the greatest calamity in the history of our country. We all wanted to get serious about protecting the health and safety of our people, but shutting down businesses and shutting down the economy and isolating people was a horrific idea that probably, in my opinion, had social costs that were multiple times greater than any social benefit. But so I guess the answer is yes, we have dug ourselves into a huge hole, but I do believe we can survive this. I do think we can put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But, you know, you look at the spending that is in Joe Biden's program. He wants to add, according to the Wall Street Journal this morning, Mark, another $7 trillion over the next 10 years. Now, I'll just say one last thing and turn it over to Peter. I'm going to give Joe Biden some credit. Okay. And by the way, I know there are Republicans, Democrats, independents, you know, libertarians, all sorts listening to the show. So I don't mean this to be a pro-Trump rally by any means. I'm a big Trump guy, but I look, a lot of this spending happened because of Trump. Trump believes in government spending. But what I'm here to tell you is that Joe Biden has been honest. He's been perfectly honest to the American people about what he wants to do. People should read his economic program. He's been very specific about what he wants to do. I think it's catastrophic, but he wants to raise every single tax you can think of. The capital gains tax, the corporate tax, the death tax. He wants to raise payroll taxes on the rich. All of these things to pay for all this massive spending. And so you get into this tax and spend cycle that I think would be ruinous. So those are my comments. I do think we can put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But the American people are going to have to put pressure on the politicians to stop spending so much money.
Yeah, so Peter, you were, as I mentioned in the introduction, you were famous for your fantastic prediction that the 2008 financial crisis was coming upon us, that it was going to be much worse than we thought. You're absolutely right. Then we had a major, massive recovery based primarily on the Federal Reserve stimulus packages, and it turned things around and so forth. Now we're facing another situation, which is not unlike 2008. Is this worse than 2008? And can we put Humpty Dumpty back together again? Steve thinks we can. What do you think?
Well, first of all, Mark, we didn't have a recovery after 2008. We didn't recover from anything. We got sicker. The Federal Reserve just blew an even bigger bubble after 2008,
we had full employment. We went to full employment. Come on, you've got to.
It doesn't matter. It's how we got there. We got there from artificially low interest rates and excess money printing and government spending. That's why the economy was so vulnerable to COVID-19, because it was a gigantic bubble. We never had a sound recovery. But I want to back up and talk about what Stephen, some of the points that he made. I mean, first of all, the government lending program was a disaster. First of all, the government doesn't have the constitutional authority to lend money to anybody. Number two, the government doesn't have any money to lend. The government only has money that it takes from the private sector. Now, in this case, it decided to take from the private sector through inflation. The government extended these massive loans by having the Federal Reserve conjure money into existence. And by the way, most of these loans are never going to be repaid. So they're not actually loans, they're grants. It's welfare. A lot of it is welfare for the rich, but all of it was wrong. And, you know, right now, the government is spending, or 60 cents out of every dollar the government is spending out is being created by the Federal Reserve. The Fed is printing more money than the government is raising in taxes. And so this inflation tax is enormous. We're not getting all this government for free. Donald Trump is a big taxer, right? Because every dime of government spending is a dime of taxation. And he was signing these big increases in government spending even before COVID. The deficits were already running out of control before COVID. There were a lot of opportunities that Trump had to veto those spending bills and to try to actually cut government spending. In fact, now he's just using executive orders to expand government, to make government bigger. Why not use the presidency while he has it to try to make government smaller? I mean, the only way you're going to make America great again is to make government small again. But Donald Trump has used his first 3 years in office to make government bigger, to spend more, and to cheerlead the Federal Reserve to print more. I mean, when he was a candidate, at least he criticized Janet Yellen for artificially low interest rates and blowing up a stock market bubble. But when he became president, he demanded even lower interest rates than zero. He wanted Powell to go negative. He wants more QE. He doesn't want a real economy. He just wants a big bubble. And when he was a candidate for president, he made fun of these phony government statistics. And now he loves government statistics. All he does is tout them, although now the government statistics don't look as rosy as they did before COVID. But look, I'm not, you know, making this a debate, a Trump-Biden debate. I mean, I'll concede that Trump is the lesser of the two evils. And if I still had the right to vote, I'd vote for Trump. But being the lesser of two evils and being good, there's a big difference, right? Trump has governed like a Democrat. He's a big government, big spender. He just doesn't want to be honest about taxation. He doesn't want to raise taxes to pay for a bigger government. He just wants to print money to pay for a bigger government, as if all that money printing is free. It's not. It is a massive tax increase, and it's going to hit hardest the people who can least afford to pay.
Okay, now, Stephen, we haven't had a lot of positive comments about Trump. Can you give us a list of the good things that Trump has done that have been good for the economy and good for the stock market?
Well, sure. I mean, I wrote a book about this a year ago called Trumponomics. Look, I think that Peter is right, that Donald Trump is not an ideological free market conservative like the three of us are and many of the people watching this. I mean, he's not ideological. He's a kind of common sense businessman. You're right, Peter. He is a Keynesian. You know, he is a Keynesian. He really does believe government spending stimulates the economy. I think most people, well, actually, there are a lot. I've been surprised. I don't know about you guys. How many economists actually believe that BS? I mean, all the economists, right, Mark? I mean, I'd say 80% of them think government spending is a stimulus. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, even supply-side economists, as you know, one of the criticisms of supply-side economists is that you poo-poo the deficit, that you can spend, that you can tax cut and stimulate the economy to reduce it. But unless you have control of government spending somehow with some kind of limitation, a constitutional limitation on government, the deficits are going to continue to be a problem. But what I'd like you, Steve, to talk about is tax cuts. I mean, Peter said that Donald Trump raised taxes. I'm not sure what he meant by that, because I don't think that's true. He cut taxes pretty significantly.
Mark, my point is that government spending equals taxation. That every dollar the government spends is a dollar the private sector has to finance. So it's the spending that's the taxes. I will concede that he cut income taxes, but he increased government spending. And so the income tax cut is a lie. He's financing government through inflation. The Fed is taking our purchasing power rather than the government taking our money.
Right. But you have to see the supply side argument, Peter, that Stephen makes and so on, is that when you change marginal tax rates, it can stimulate the economy, can grow the economy in legitimate ways that can be self-financing. So to what extent are those tax cuts a good thing? I mean, if Biden gets in, he eliminates completely the corporate tax break, the long-term capital gains. I mean, can investors survive with no long-term capital gains rate and paying up to 40-50% in taxes?
The Biden tax rates are a disaster. But the problem is, Mark, we need to cut government spending. Trump actually signed on to increases in government spending at the same time he was cutting taxes. What Trump needed to do is reduce government spending first, eliminate departments, eliminate agencies, reduce spending. And then after you relieve the taxpayer of the burden of paying for government, then you can cut taxes. You can't just cut taxes and increase spending. That's what he did.
Okay, but I'm talking about incentives. You don't understand incentives.
I do.
If you cut the marginal tax rate, you do encourage productivity. Do you follow me on that?
Yes, I understand if you lower the top rate, you could get more revenue, but he increased government spending. So even if he got more revenue from the tax cuts, he gave it up by increasing government spending.
Okay. Yeah. Steve,
where are the cuts to government spending? Where are the cuts to entitlements? We didn't get any.
So, Stephen, you argue that Humpty Dumpty can be put back together again. Tell me how we're going to do that. Let's assume Trump wins. He's behind in the polls. The election betting odds that John Stossel puts together show Biden win, even though Biden is a person who is half gone most of the time. It's incredible to me that the Democrats would put up a candidate who is heading towards senility. It's really a dangerous type of situation to put someone in.
A senile Democrat might be better than one that's all there.
So tell me, Stephen, what is your formula? If you could sit down with President Trump, and I know occasionally you do, and he gets a second term, how is he going to solve some of these problems?
Okay, well, there's a lot there. Let me start by saying this, that, look, I worked on the 2016 campaign. At this time, in August of 2016, all the major pollsters and political prognosticators said that Hillary Clinton has a 90% chance of winning the election. So I honestly view this race as pretty close to a toss-up. I would say slightly Trump because he has the advantage of incumbency and because the economy is going to get better in the fall. And that will. So I think it's a pretty close to a toss up. Anyone out there who thinks that Joe Biden has this in the bag is totally deluded. And I hope that what Democrats think, because that's how they lost in 2016. So it's a toss up. Maybe and it could go either way. I really believe that. Okay. Second point. What did Trump do right? I mean, look, we had the best economy in arguably 30 or 40 years after the first 3 years of Trump's policies, the tax cuts, the deregulation, the promoting of American energy policy. Trump is the only guy who was gutsy enough to do what I think is maybe one of his great accomplishments, was pulling America out of the anti-America Paris Climate Accord, which is a joke. It's just a massive tax on the American people. Not a single country in the world is complying with. In fact, the only country that's complying with the Paris Climate Accord is the United States, and we're not part of it. All the countries that signed it cheated. Gee, who would have ever thought that happened, right? That a country would violate a treaty. He's done amazing things. Look at him on school choice. I can't think of any president, even Ronald Reagan, that is more supportive of giving money to parents, not the school blob and the evil teachers unions. And I think I can say that now after their actions of the last 2 or 3 months. They're the most selfish, evil group, interest group in America. The way they are saying, not only do they not want to teach, they say they won't teach until it's like extortion, until we have Medicare for all, Green New Deal, higher taxes on the rich and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's hard to find things where Trump really hasn't delivered on his promises. And so that's a very, very positive record. In fact, I remember in January, this past January, thinking, Mark, this is all too good. It's too beautiful a picture. We have rising wages, the biggest reduction in poverty in like 40 years. We had black incomes up, Hispanic incomes up, Asian incomes up, single mothers' incomes up. You know, the wages were rising. You saw, just across the board, manufacturing, construction, mining had gained 1.5 million jobs, those blue-collar jobs. And I remember thinking, something is going to happen. Maybe a meteor is going to hit the United States or something like that. And who would have ever thought it would have been a virus? But now the real issue is, who of these two candidates can get us back on track? And I just don't think that's a hard choice. I mean, if you look at what the two candidates stand for, I think it's...
Well, first of all...
One last point, Peter, and then I'll turn it over to you. You're right. I mean, you are right, Peter, that government spending is taxation. No question about it. If a government spends a dollar, it has to be collected in taxes either now or later. You are 100% correct on that. And our Laffer says, the godfather of the supply side movement agrees with you. Government spending is taxation. And that's why government spending doesn't stimulate the economy, because all you're doing is basically taking, the only way that the government can give you, Mark, a dollar is to take a dollar away from me or someone else, right? I mean, the government doesn't create any resources. And so, I am troubled by the massive increase in spending, but I think we've done a really good job on the tax and regulatory side, and just having a president who is pro-business. And that matters a lot. I mean, look what happened to consumer confidence, small business confidence, literally the day Donald Trump was elected. Many of you seen my charts on this. It just went through the roof. I think if you see Biden elected president, you're going to see the day after that, the biggest decline in small business confidence, maybe in American history.
Peter. Well, there's no question that hopes were raised high when Trump was elected. And unfortunately, the much hoped for reduction in the size of government never took place. But, I was arguing with partisan Republicans on, CNBC and Fox, for all of George W. Bush's two terms, pretty much. And they kept telling me how great the economy was, the greatest story never told, the Goldilocks economy. And I kept telling these Republicans that it was a bubble, that we didn't really have a good economy. The Fed had just inflated a housing bubble. And we were, had this phony wealth, and we were spending too much money based on this wealth effect engineered by the Fed, and that we were running up too much debt. And I said this thing was going to end in disaster, that we were going to have a collapse. And that's exactly what happened. The problem is, what we've been experiencing under Trump is part of a bigger bubble than that. I mean, he inherited it from Obama, so Trump didn't start it, but he didn't do anything to change the dynamics. As I said, he became a cheerleader for the Fed to continue to blow air into the bubble, especially when the bubble started to deflate on its own in the fourth quarter of 2018, after the Fed had finally returned interest rates up to maybe 2%, and they had shrunk the balance sheet a little bit, then everything started to collapse. And then Donald Trump was beating up Powell. We need rate cuts. We need 0% rates. We need more QE. And Trump and Powell obliged. And then, of course, when COVID hit, we went all the way to zero in QE4, which is already bigger than QE1, 2, and 3 combined, which is another forecast that I had from the beginning. But we can't confuse a bubble with legitimate economic growth. Yes, you can temporarily reduce the unemployment rate. You can goose up the stock market and make everything look good on the surface. But beneath the surface is a disaster waiting to happen. And unfortunately, this disaster has already started. And it is going to get much, much worse. This is a bigger financial crisis than the one we had in 2008. And the reference to Humpty Dumpty, see, the problem is, this is a Humpty Dumpty economy for me. But the Federal Reserve put this thing together where it kept interest rates artificially low every time there was a problem. And so we would take on even more debt. But the more debt we have, the harder it is for the Fed to allow interest rates to rise, because every time there's a problem, the solution is more debt. But the problems always start because too much debt. And instead of allowing the debt to be restructured and defaulted and having a real recovery, we just encourage even more debt. And so now we're at a point where, we can't even afford any interest rate that's positive. We have so much debt that the most we can afford is zero. And in fact, most of the debt has to be monetized by the Fed because there's not enough private buyers to buy up this negative yielding bonds in real terms. And I think we're headed for a real crisis this time, a dollar crisis, which will set off a sovereign debt crisis. And this is going to be so much more severe. And it could even start before Trump finishes his term. I mean, we are living so close to the edge right now. It's hard to tell whether we're going to fall off before the end of Trump's term or after.
I think, Peter, there is something that you have overlooked, and that is how major corporations dealt with the 2008 financial crisis. There's a number of things that major corporations and small businesses did. They cut their costs to the bone. They became much more productive, much more efficient. Look at the amount of cash that corporations, even today, Microsoft, Apple, Google, and so on, if you look at the amount of cash, it is far exceeding what existed 10 or 20 years ago. So they're in much better financial shape than they have ever been to deal with these crises. You totally ignore that sort of thing.
Well, first of all, a lot of the cash was actually borrowed. So they have cash on their balance sheet because they issued debt to get that cash. I mean, a lot of companies have done that because the debt is so cheap. But proof of the matter is, look what happened after COVID-19 hit, right? As soon as these companies lost some revenue, they were broke. They didn't have a big savings that they could fall back on. Look what happened to the bond market. The bond market imploded. The government had to come in, or they didn't have to, but they did because they were afraid to buy up all these bonds because the market, there was no cash there. There was no, and American citizens too. Everybody is living paycheck to paycheck. Once upon a time in America, people have 6 months, a year's worth of living expenses in the bank. So they could then go without a job for a few months. It was no big deal. But now nobody can go without a paycheck. That's it. The minute you're not getting paid, you got no money to pay your rent, to pay your mortgage, to make your car payment or your credit card debt or your student loans. The entire economy is levered up thanks to all these years of artificially low interest rates.
Let me kind of respond. Look, this is the area where Peter and I, you know, fundamentally disagree. I've been much more worried about deflation than inflation. We've had, at least for the last 9 months, we've had deflation in the economy. Look at the commodities, they've fallen dramatically. Now, the last month or so, they've rallied, for sure.
Yeah, copper's up to $3. No question about
that. But they're still way, I mean, I like to look at the commodity index as a measure of inflation. When I was, you know, nominated for the Fed, I made that point over and over again to the people at the Fed that you should be looking at commodities as a good index. Look what happened, you know, look what happened to commodities in the 1970s. The way that Paul Volcker broke the back of inflation was he started targeting commodity prices. And remember, commodity prices more than quadrupled in the 70s. And then in the 80s, they went down dramatically as the Fed got control of the money supply. So the issue really, to me, is if you look at commodity prices, they signal almost no inflation. Now, I know the last month or so, we've seen a tick up of inflation. But prior to that, there was actually deflation. There was, the commodity prices were falling. Now, here's why I disagree with you, Peter, on something that you and I have talked about and debated for the last couple of years, and I just don't know if I've ever gotten a satisfactory answer. If you are right that we are facing a dollar crisis, and if you are right that all of this money creation is going to lead to inflation, by the way, that would be, you know, a kind of textbook 101, you know, if you print a lot of money, you would expect inflation. But the fact of the matter is people are buying 30-year bonds at a 1.5% interest rate. And that is telling us that the market is saying that they believe that, and by the way, the Fed,
to answer your question,
is two, let me just finish this. The Fed has basically said they want 2% CPI, and we've been below that consistently. We've been at least, at most half of that level. And the fact is, you can say that there's inflation, I can say that there's deflation, but what the market is telling us is there's zero indication of inflation. People wouldn't be buying 10-year treasury bills at 1%, and they wouldn't be buying 30-year treasury bills at a rate of 1.5% if they thought we were going to have 4, 5, 6% inflation.
All right, let me respond to this. And first of all, we know inflation, by definition, is the expansion of the money supply. So that's what we have. The Fed is inflating. Prices can move in reaction to inflation, but you can't look at the bond market and say, oh, interest rates are low, so there's no inflation. The Fed is manipulating the bond market. The Fed is buying all these bonds. If the Federal Reserve was not in the market buying treasuries, and there were actually people investing their own money in long-term treasury bonds at these low rates, maybe you would have a point. But the only reason interest rates are so low is because the Federal Reserve is artificially suppressing them. And so you can't look at bonds like you could have in the past. You know what you could look at? The price of gold. Gold was at $2,000 an ounce and going up. That's not happening because there's no inflation. That is telling you, right? Gold price is what people are doing. People don't want to buy these treasuries. They're buying gold. It's the Federal Reserve that's printing money and buying these treasuries because the Federal Reserve doesn't give a damn about how much money it loses. But there's no way, Steve, are you buying personally 30-year U.S. treasuries at these low interest rates at 1.4%?
I am not, but everybody in the world
put your own money into those things.
All I'm saying,
right, but no, I don't know anybody who is either.
Well, but
because
look,
you know the inflation rate is higher than that. The market is rigged. It's manipulated, and there's
it would just be a wonderful world.
And there's nothing wrong with falling prices. Falling prices are good. Too bad we don't have that.
Now let me add, you brought up gold, and I'd like to talk about the two hottest areas of investing. And there seems to be legitimacy for both of them. One is the tech sector. The tech sector is very hot, especially online. And we just saw Target come out and report. They've had a dramatic increase. A lot of it's online buying and so forth because of the pandemic. People are staying at home. People are buying. So Amazon is at highs. Apple is a $2 trillion company right now. But they have fundamentals. They have sales to support this. It's not just totally artificial. So of the two sectors, the tech sector and the gold sector, which do you think is the future of the United States? Do you think that as an investor, we have thousands of investors, Money Show people who are listening right now, they understand the economics that you raise, that both of you raise. So where should people put their money? Should they put them in these tech sectors? Should they put them in gold? I certainly am doing that myself. I'm 100% invested in these areas. How long will we continue to see a bull market in tech stocks and in gold? Who wants to answer that question?
Well, maybe I'll start. I'll take it. Well, first of all, it's inflation is driving the interest in
go ahead.
Inflation is driving investors into both because investors know that treasuries are a lousy deal, that inflation is much higher than these manipulated and artificially suppressed rates. So cash is trash. People have to find someplace to go, but they don't want to invest in these brick and mortar companies that, you know, that are actually losing money now and that are in a lot of trouble. So I think you have a narrow set of these tech stocks that people are hiding out in as a way to get out of, you know, depreciating fiat currency. And so they're buying these, and there's a lot of momentum in these stocks. And I think there are some shorts that are, you know, being squeezed out. So you're seeing a lot of these things, but I don't think their earnings justify these share prices. I think it is a bubble in these tech stocks. I'd rather buy, you know, some other types of stocks. But when it comes to the gold stocks, the biggest beneficiary of all this monetary policy, of this, all the stimulus and the bailouts is going to be gold, right? Gold prices are going much, much higher, and gold stocks are the industry that I think is going to most benefit from this. I mean, forget about trying to figure out which companies benefit from people who don't have jobs and who stay at home and who spend money that they get in the mail that the Federal Reserve printed. I want to own what's benefiting from all this money printing, and that's going to be gold and all these gold companies that have gold inventory, gold in the ground that they can dig up and sell and to be making tremendous amounts of money. Even Warren Buffett can see this. I mean, he went and bought a stake in Barrick Gold. We have no idea how much he's bought, you know, since that's disclosure is about 7 weeks old. But I think that says a lot when someone like Warren Buffett is finally moving into gold stocks. That's for my money. That's what I'm buying. I mean, I'm not participating in this tech mania. You know, I'd rather buy the, you know, after it collapses and figure out what I want to buy there. But I think there's a tremendous value right now in the mining sector.
So Steve, I would tend to agree with that. I mean, look, you're right. Gold is a hedge against two things, inflation And look, you may be right that inflation, look, I think I would never buy one of those 30-year bonds at 1.5% interest rates. I think it's the most insane buy that I can't. Who out there is buying these bonds?
The Fed. That's my point. The Fed is doing it.
But so the second point I would make is this, that a rising gold price is a horrible thing for an economy, right? Because what a rising gold price is an indication of is an end of the world, that people think that it's what people buy in crisis. And so the fact that the gold price is rising is an indication of both inflation and people worried about the world economy, that this coronavirus isn't under control and so on. So I would say this, I think we did substantial long-term damage to our economy over the last 4 or 5 months. That's why I think people who say that the lockdowns were an effective thing to do or an appropriate thing to do, in my opinion, are crazy. As I said earlier, I think the evidence is quite clear that the damage that we did to our economy by shutting down our businesses was multiple times higher than any benefit. And the problem is that those costs are only just starting to be realized. In other words, it could take years and years. Well, first of all, once a business, I was on the board of two companies that were doing pretty well. They looked like they were going to be, you know, and these were people who put their whole lives in these businesses, and both of them collapsed when the economy got shut down. They didn't have enough cash to get through it. And there are a lot of businesses like that. And once a business goes bankrupt, it's not like Lazarus that it can come back from the dead. Yeah.
Steve, I would make one point, because I agree with you that policy did a lot of damage, but what did even more damage was paying for it with debt and money printing. Okay. Yeah, so it's the Federal Reserve, it's government spending that's going to actually do more damage than shutting down the business.
I agree. Peter, I'm agreeing with you. I think that most of what we've done as a policy response to coronavirus, I agree with you, has been a mistake. I think the fact that we were giving, I was for loans, they weren't loans, they turned into grants to companies. I think paying people 2 or 3 times more money for being unemployed than working was absolutely asinine. And yet, these are your friends, Mark, your economist friends. Oh, it's so great for the economy that we're paying people double what they were making when they were earning or going back to the job, because that stimulates the economy. You have PhD economists who are making these idiotic amounts. I mean, in that case, why don't we pay people $10,000 a week in unemployment benefits? So we made a lot of mistakes, and I think it's going to be a tough road ahead. And I think that if we make a mistake, if we have a hobbled economy this fall or one that's not growing much, and then on top of that, you elect someone who wants to raise taxes, massively increase spending, massively increase taxes, and then, you know, decapitate the American oil and gas industry, which creates 8 million jobs. That is a very, very frightening thing. And, you know, as my son said to me, I think he summarized things really well. He's voting in his first election this November. And he said, Dad, I don't know who to vote for. He said, if I vote for, Donald Trump, we're going to have 4 more years of chaos. He said, if I vote for Joe Biden, we're going to have a Great Depression. I thought, smart kid, you know, those are the two choices, crisis or chaos or depression, because you cannot, when an economy is limping along, you know, increase government spending, increase government regulation, and increase taxation, and think that
But Trump is doing that. Trump is increasing government. We need to cut government spending, and Trump refuses to do that. And in a weak economy, government is a bigger burden. Government spending needs to be cut. That's the only way to stimulate the economy.
Let's get serious here. We know government is not going to cut spending. We just know that Trump is not going to do that. When Biden gets in, he's not going to do that. But here's the question. What can we do to get the economy going again? How can we limit? What are the lessons we have learned? What are the lessons we have learned about excessive emergency power in the name of these executive orders that governors, mayors, and even the president of the United States have? Is there anything that's going to be done to limit their power? Because that's the real problem. They were able to shut down the economy because they had, with the stroke of a pen, that emergency power.
Mark, you are so scary. You are so right. And, you know, we've been talking about the economy, and yet we haven't talked about the cost of freedom. You know, the freedom has taken a huge hit here. And, you know, it goes back to James Madison, who said crisis is the rallying cry of the tyrant. And that was never more true than what we've seen in the last 4 months, that anytime there's a crisis, government almost always does the wrong thing. And they did it again here. And that's I think Peter is right. I mean, the most important thing right now is we need to keep the tax rates low, but we have to start cutting government spending. Government spending is crowding out private investment, is crowding out private employment. It's amazing to me, by the way, if you look, Mark, at the 2000, the Q2 numbers on the GDP, the sector of the economy, the only sector of the economy that really grew other than technology was government. And by the way, just one a little kind of interesting aside, Peter, or Mark, I wonder if you know the answer to this. Outside of like recreation and leisure, do you know what sector of the economy took the biggest hit in the second quarter of GDP?
Well, I assume hotels and...
Other than that, what was it? I mean, most people don't. I was shocked when I saw these numbers. You know what it is, Peter?
What?
Healthcare.
Well, oh, yeah, because people wouldn't go to the doctor. Yeah, exactly.
Biggest crisis in America, and we shut down hospitals. We shut down, medical centers, and people went months without cancer treatments, dealing with other health problems and so on. I mean, is that an example of the stupidity of government?
Look, I mean, normally the government causes the crisis and then uses the crisis to usurp more power. But in this situation, they blew up a crisis out of COVID. They saw the opportunity to overreact and then make an even bigger economic problem and then use it to usurp even more power. Look, it's going to get a lot worse. That means the government's going to get a lot bigger. They're going to use the expanded authority. But, in answer to Mark's question about is there anything we can do to fix the economy, it's impossible to fix it by blowing more air into the bubble. The only way to fix this economy is to let the bubble deflate. So asset prices have to come down, interest rates have to go up, investors have to lose money, jobs have to be lost, businesses have to fail, debt has to be restructured, government has to cut spending. We need an economic reset so we can build up a real economy on savings, underconsumption, and capital investment.
Peter, you missed the whole point in my question. What I was suggesting was we got business back to work. If people went back to work so that you have the sports, people going to games, you have the people going into hotels, they're going to conferences, they're going on cruise ships. Everything that has been shut down needs to be opened up. If you did that, that's a lot better solution than yours. Just let everything collapse. Nobody wants that. Come on.
No, but if we do, but how do, we can't keep propping it up with cheap money. That is the problem.
By getting people back to work. Don't you get that?
No, I'm not saying the government should stop people from going back to work, but the Fed has to let interest rates go up to where the market wants them, and we have to deal with that crisis. Deal with interest rates at 5 or 10%. I don't know where they're going to go. They're going to be much, much higher than they are now.
Peter, first things first, get people back to work.
But how are we going to do that?
Well, it's called let people do, stop interfering with the economy at the governor levels. The governors need to set back and say, okay, everybody go back to work.
But we were headed into a severe recession before COVID, and we have even more debt now than we did then. So we have a huge debt problem. We can't go back to the way we were before COVID because we can't reflate this bubble.
So Stephen, we haven't talked a lot about a big outlier in this system, and that's the Swedish model. Have you looked at what Sweden did? They had a partial lockdown, but not very much. So tell us, was that a success story or was that a failure? Can we learn something from the Swedes?
Yeah, we can. And I am very familiar with the story. But look, the story isn't over yet, so it's a little premature to draw, sweeping conclusions. But what happened in Sweden is they never locked down their economy, and they took a big hit up front in terms of a lot of hospitalizations and a lot of deaths from coronavirus. But I think what we're learning about coronavirus, Mark, I mean, again, it's a virus, and it's always hard to predict these things. But it looks like what the coronavirus is a hurricane. It's a hurricane, and it sweeps through and it does substantial damage to an economy. Look at the northeastern states, look at Europe. It swept through there, it caused a lot of deaths, By the way, 80% of the deaths were elderly or people, and 90% when you include people with pre-existing conditions. There was never any case for, you know, shutting down schools and things. That was the stupidest thing ever. And now we've got, you know, 80% of the schools aren't opening up when, you know, an 8-year-old is more likely to be struck by lightning than to die from coronavirus. But the, did you see, by the way, do you guys see the poll that came out today about, it was from one of the major pollsters, and they asked people what they thought the risk of was of coronavirus versus what it was. And what they found was that people underestimated the risk of older people by about 50%, but they vastly, vastly overstated the risk of young people by like fivefold. The public doesn't get this. Here we are 5 months into this crisis, Mark, and people don't even understand what's going on.